Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
So we'll be in 1 Samuel 23, the second half of this, starting in verse 15. But just in a way of introduction, we need to be reminded that David has been now on the run ever since chapter 19. Running after Saul's men came to his house to watch. But even since chapter 18, we've noticed that Saul eyed David from that day on, that the tension was already there. But then again, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. And this has continued throughout these chapters. It's hard for us to be able to grasp this around our head, been on the run for such a long time. But ever since that night when he'd been fleeing from his house, he's basically been on the run ever since that moment. Now, some people have asked, heard people say that it's really hard to live a life on the road, a life traveling, whether you're a musician. We had a former church elder at the previous church, and he traveled the world for business. You'd be able to talk to him on Sunday and ask him where he was going that week, and he'd either India or China or, you know, up to Pennsylvania to be able to inspect something or some phone call. He'd fly across the world, be there for an hour meeting, and then come right back. He would fly first class, something that we all might want to know what's behind that curtain. He flew first class all the time. He'd eat at nice restaurants, stay at nice hotels, but roughly he would spend a third of the year out on the road, away from home. And this, he'd spend this time living in a suitcase. And this luxurious thing that might sound good to us, when you actually get to it, it's not very nice. And David wasn't running, he wasn't flying in first class, he wasn't living in first class hotels, eating at nice restaurants, but in caves and fleeing Saul for his life. And David hasn't returned home at this point. He's been on a run since that moment he left that house that night. He didn't even grab any weapons that night. That's how fast he fled. But now we've seen him run basically all over Judah. It's hard for us to be able to grasp this. You know, this could have been years. Saul was king for about 40 years. So we don't know the period of time between David and Goliath and when Saul's reign comes to an end. But he's been to Ramah. He's been to Naioth at Ramah, at Nob, at Gath, at the cave of Abdullon, Mizpah in Moab, the forest of Hereth, Keilah, and now in the wilderness of Ziph. He's been running for his life, and most likely all this is on foot. Not having the ability maybe to be able to look after a horse in a cave. But he also then has about 600 men that are with him as well. And it's hard to escape when you're in this situation. And tonight we see this pursuit continue. We actually add four additional places to this list, and we'll end up in Gedi, right near the Dead Sea. But this really is like a movie. The movie The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. He runs from his life after being accused of murder of his wife and, you know, standing on that viaduct with his hands behind his head and guns pointed at him. But at the last minute, he jumps. And that's kind of what happens tonight. It all closed down. This near escape, which happens, or the great escape with Steve McQueen. The prisoners of war running for their life, basically. This has been David's life ever since leaving his house. And tonight we actually see Saul get very, very close. You know, Saul within this map has really never been close to David, knowing where he is. He last week learned about Keilah and Dave and him pursuing him in Keilah. But here he gets very, very close. So the first thing we see tonight is Jonathan's words of comfort. Jonathan's words of comfort in verses 41 to 18. The last we heard of Jonathan was in chapter 20, when Jonathan and David were there and they made this covenant. Jonathan had just found out who his father was, and his personality. And here they are weeping, embracing one another as they realize this is what their life is going to look like. And Jonathan explains that go in peace because we have sworn both of us the name of the Lord, saying the Lord shall be between me and you and between my offspring forever and ever. This close relationship, these great brothers are embracing one another. They leave, and now it's, you know, a long time after. Again, we don't get a sense of what time is in this narrative, but it's been a long time. And finally, they get to meet each other again. David's in the wilderness of Ziph, and Saul saw him, but the Lord did not give him into his hand. And David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And then we need to notice just briefly that Psalm 63, the title of Psalm 63 is the Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. So maybe this psalm is written during this time. He's running in the wilderness. Wilderness comes up time and time again. So this is the section where Psalm 63 happens. But also in 2 Samuel 15, this happens again, that he's in Kidron near the brook, and he passed towards the wilderness in verse 28 in chapter 15 in 2 Samuel. Wait there in the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So there's two instances now. It doesn't explain what wilderness he's in. So Psalm 63 could be written here. However, in Psalm 63 it says, "But the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him, shall exult, for the mouths of the liars will be stopped." So my assumption here is that it's that the king shall rejoice in God speaks of David actually being king. That this time in 1 Samuel, although he's anointed as king, he never really refers to himself as King David. That becomes more common in 2 Samuel. The king of Gath refers to him, "Is this not the king of Israel?" But my assumption is to believe this is Psalm 63 is written in 2 Samuel 15, not 1 Samuel 23. But last week we looked at Saul and Saul and the difference, contrast between Saul and David. And Saul finally thought that David was given into his hands. The Lord did not allow it. In verse 14 it explains. But tonight we'll see the same thing again, that in his hands comes up again and again in these couple of chapters in 23 and 24. And in this brief encounter, we then find an oasis for David as he's running for his life, like having a taste of home with meeting Jonathan here. You know, that taste of home when you haven't been there a long time. People often ask me, what do I miss the most about Australia? And the answer is always my family. Like, that's the main thing that I miss, not being able to see my brothers and my sisters, my nieces, my nephews, my parents. But if you were to push me a little bit further, it might be fish and chips. Now, I've tried to buy fish and chips over here, but they're just not the same. And every Saturday night, we would grow up, and our family would order fish and chips from the local fish and chip restaurant, and we would get them, and like seagulls, we would devour them. But that to me is one of the taste of home that really is, when we go back, we just have to get that because it's hard to find over here. And we can find other things over here that but that's one of the main things. And here, David has a small slither of a taste of home with meeting with Jonathan. And this is in verse 16. He finds just a slither of encouragement, a water station on a marathon, a space for him to be able to find rest. And Jonathan comes to David in verse 16, and he strengthened his hand in God. It says, Jonathan, Saul's son. Again, we're reminded of this relationship that Jonathan is Saul's son, but more importantly, he's David's brother, you know, is David's friend. He goes to David at Horesh, and he strengthened his hand in God. What a beautiful phrase when you think about David running for his life, worried about what is around the corner, and here he meets Jonathan. What a friendship that is. And he strengthened his hand in God. Matthew Henry explains that he strengthened his hands for action by encouraging his heart, not in the creature, but in God. He strengthened his hand in God, not merely just his hands to be able to carry this out, but really to encourage his heart. And this is what a true friend really does, points the believer to God. How does he strengthen David's hand? He utters four things in verse 17. He says, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you." Saul my father also knows this, that he says four things here that strengthens his hand. Do not fear, Saul shall not find you. The second thing is, you shall be king. The third thing is, I shall be next to you. And number four is, Saul knows this. First thing he says is, do not fear. What a simple words that resonate in such a moment of silence. Often the encouragement to do not fear comes because fear is surrounding them. The angel of the Lord comes to be able to deliver a message, and the first thing that they say, do not fear. And this is what Jonathan's words are. Words that David has himself written that we've looked at in Psalm 34:9, are the fear of the Lord, fear of the Lord, you His saints. For those who fear Him have no lack. And here, sometimes we feel like we can tell our children over and over again, or just bring things up. But then finally it just clicks and he says, do not fear. And he gives the reason why he shall not fear, and that Saul will not find you. He shall not find you. We've already noted that Saul is not the best person to ask to help you find your keys. He went looking for his donkey and couldn't find his donkey. They happen to come back. We've noted that he's bad at directions. He gets lost frequently. He's not the best person when it comes to hunting. And here, Jonathan's encouragement is, do not fear. Why? Because Saul will not find you. And the second thing he says is that you shall be king. That these words might not have even been on David's mind. You know, thinking about what tomorrow will bring. Am I going to live? Where is Saul? Where am I going to move to next? Where am I going to run to if something happens and there's people at the door? Where am I going to run to? What am I going to grab? But being king maybe just seems such a long way off to him. How about just having a house, a warm bed to sleep on, a nice meal? But here Jonathan encourages him by strengthening his hands and he's saying, you shall be king. Maybe he's taken back to 1 Samuel 16:13, when Samuel took that horn of oil and appointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. But also another encouraging thing he says is, he says, I shall be next to you. Again, what an encouraging words to think of at this point. Not only you shall be king, but I'll be next to you. All this running that you've done that you haven't had someone by your side, I will be there and I will support you as king. Me, who's the prince to the throne, the one who is next in line, I will be beside you as I serve you as king. What a joyous moment that would be for Jonathan and David. And he shows his allegiance to David, laying down his own right. And he says that you will be king and I will be right there beside you. And what encouraging words that might be as David faces these battles alone, maybe to have his armor bearer, Jonathan, beside this. But he also then finally says that Saul, my father, knows this. And we'll see in chapter 24, Saul actually recognizes this for the first time. But Jonathan knows this before Saul, whether we don't know exactly what this is, but it seems that Saul is willing to chase down David to believe that the Lord has given him into his hands. He feels like he's able to circumvent God's will to go around it, although God has said that like this robe that you've ripped from Samuel, this is what will be left of your kingdom. You will no longer be king. I will raise up someone else whose heart is after me. But here, Jonathan knows that Saul knows this will actually happen. Whether this is because Saul has told him specifically what happened there with Samuel in the corner of the rope, whether he's figured it out. Saul is just anxious. It's eating out at him. But again, they then make another covenant before the Lord. The Lord, even though these hardships and difficult times, they're still able to recognize that their relationship and their bond together, united by the Lord, the covenant-keeping God of Israel. This godly friendship, they exhort. Jonathan merely just says 32 words to him. And he strengthens him in the hand of God. In this difficult time, Jonathan's few words are able to be able to strengthen, to give him some sustenance to be able to keep on going. And just think about what few words might be able to be able to encourage someone else as they're going through a difficult time, as a friend comes beside them, to be able to encourage them with 32 words, whether that's a letter, a phone call, a meal, a card, or even just a word or 32 words, to be able to strengthen and encourage another believer who's going through these hardships. That here, this bond which is found before, this covenants which they've made before the Lord, and here, even in this difficult time, Jonathan, it takes a large time to be able to go risk his life, to be able to visit David, but in this time, he strengthened David's hand. You think about running the amount of time he has, but yet Jonathan's words help him tremendously. But now it changes quite swiftly. The chase is now on yet again. A small little oasis has passed. This time has come. And now in verses 19 to 28, we see this chase come to fruition. That the Ziphites went up to Saul at Gilboa, saying, Is not David hiding among us in the strongholds of Horesh, on the hill of Hakilah, which is south of Jeshimon? That here the Ziphites come to Saul. He's now in the wilderness of Ziph, and the Ziphites come to Saul and finally just say, surrender him into his hands. Maybe they're concerned. Maybe they want a benefit. Move up in the chains. This is, you know, a good place for the king to build his summer house, or, this would be good for the economy. But let's go make our allegiance with Saul the king. And they tell him that David was at Horesh. Now, again, we'll pause and note that here in Psalm 52, Maskela David, when the Ziphites went and told Saul, it's not David hiding among us. So we'll be looking at this in a couple of weeks' time. Psalm 54, again, another psalm written in amongst these difficult times. And they come and tell Saul about David's hiding place. And we know it's the king's desire to take them into the king's hand. And they say in verse 20, now come, O king, according to your heart's desire to come down, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand. And here they explain, this is your desire. You want David? We'll give you your desire. We'll give him into your king's hand. Again, this is something we've seen, that it's falling into your hands, all your heart's desires. And Saul then responds to them and explains, may you be blessed by the Lord, for you have had compassion on me. Go, make yet more sure. Know and see the place where his foot is, and who has seen him there. For it is told me that he is very cunning. See, therefore, to take note of all the lurking places where he hides, and come back to me with sure information. Then I will go to you, and if he is in the land, I will search him out among the thousands of Judah. Again, we know what Saul is like and what David's like, but the perception in which Saul puts forward to these Ziphites is he is the honest one. He is the good person, and David is the bad person. He's very cunning. This word is used crafty, like the serpent He's like a serpent. And he invokes again the name of the Lord. We've noted this several times that often the Lord is very absent from Saul's conversations. Yet he does use the Lord, especially when he's talking to people. He does so in chapter 15 when pleading with Samuel for his life. He invokes again the name of the Lord that he might use that terminology. And Samuel in Samuel 17, when David and Goliath, David explains that he's been rescued, from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear. The Lord would deliver him from the Philistine. And Saul said to David, "Go and the Lord be with you." In chapter 18, Saul said, "Here's my eldest daughter. I'll give her to you as a wife. Be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." And again in chapter 19, and when he swore to Jonathan, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." All these outward appearances, he plays a part. Even in chapter 20, Jonathan is so surprised that what his dad's heart is actually like. There's these outward appearances that he has. And he enlists the help of the Ziphites to be able to help him. And it's hard to know what has been said about David to be able to get them to understand this position. But in the way that Saul speaks, it sounds like David is the one who is at fault. He accuses David of being very cunning. In the Hebrew, as I mentioned before, is the same word which is used in crafty in Genesis chapter 3. "Now the serpent was more crafty than all the other beasts of the field that the Lord had made." And he comes up and he asks the question of the woman, "Did God actually say?" However, who in this situation is crafty? Who is more like the serpent? Yet he accuses David of being the serpent. He accuses Saul accuses David of the thing he actually is. And he's upset about no one disclosing information to him in chapter 22, as you remember. Saul said, "Hear now the people of Benjamin, the son of Jesse will give every one of you fields and vineyards. Will he make you all commander of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Have all of you conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. No one of you is sorry for me that discloses that my son has stirred up my servant against me and lie in wait as of this day." And here we see the opposite. He coming to the Ziphites and demanding information. He wants as much information as he can get. He feels like everyone else is out to get him, and yet the Ziphites come and he says, "Give me some information." David truly in his mind is his enemy. And when you know your enemy, it's not just about having a good offense, it's about having a good defense as well. To be able to understand your enemy, you study them, you find out their weaknesses as you prepare for battle. And a great military officer is not someone who just has good combat in combat, you know, being able to have a good aim. But it's knowing what to shoot at and when. We need to be continually reminded, what is driving Saul to have this heart? His sin really of envy and jealousy, which is really fueling him. David has not harmed him, hurt him. He's served him faithfully, and yet he treats him as an enemy. So the chase then continues. Saul heads up to Ziph, behind the Ziphites, following them. But David and his men, about 600 of them, head down south to Arhar, south of Jeshimon. And in 1 Samuel 23, verse 24, they arose and went to Ziph ahead of Saul. And David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, south of Jeshimon. So Saul pursues him, and David is informed, and he went now to another place, to the rock, and he lived in the wilderness of Maon. Saul goes out to seek him, and David again is told, but he continues to pursue him. He's fueled by this understanding that finally David would be in my grasp, in my reach, in my hand. So David is now running to wilderness places. Now he's running away from cities. Now this might be a tactic in his mind to be able to run, you know, cities aren't going to, people aren't going to turn on you. Like the people in Keilah. But maybe he's cautious about what Saul would actually do. The question last time that he asked, will Saul come and destroy the city, basically? Saul has already wiped out a whole household, women and children, just because Ahimelech has given him 5 loaves of bread and a sword. And all of this on because of David's account. So maybe David is now fleeing in the wilderness to avoid, to protect the sheep of Israel. We're not too sure. But finally, Saul feels like he's got some intel and he's finally going to smell this victory. And it's at here, at the rock. Maybe it's a big rock in the wilderness that they talk about. And we think about the desert. We think maybe about the flat sand of the Sahara. But it's not always the case. In the wilderness of Maon, it would be more like sharp rock faces that are more like cliffs. And here are the rock. And Selah can mean cliff faces as well, not just a rock. But Saul goes down and finally they're on one side of the mountain. And David and his men are on the other side of the mountain. And David is running as fast as he can as he is trying just to get away from Saul. And Saul's men are catching up to him closer and closer. And finally, you know, Saul is probably thinking in his head, the Lord has given David into my hand. Finally, after all this pursuing, after all this chasing, Saul finally will get what he wants. He said in verse 7, when David had come to Keilah, and Saul said, God has given him into my hand, for he shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars. But as you can remember, we ended last week that Saul had sought him every single day, but God did not give him into his hand. And here, right at this mountain, they are both on the other side of this mountain, one in the east or one is the west, whatever it is, and they're both here. And then finally a messenger comes and tells Saul, hurry and come, the Philistines have made a raid against the land. So Saul returned from pursuing after David, and he went against the Philistines. Therefore, that place was called the Rock of Escape. That this pursuit has happened, and finally Saul is right there. And it's like those movie scenes, right, when someone is walked into a room and they're hiding. And they're trying to curb their breathing so that their breath is not heard or seen. And then there's a cat that moves outside and they leave the room quickly and finally their moment of escape has come. And this is what happens on either side of the mountain. Saul has finally said, the Lord has given him into my hand, but the Lord knows. The Lord, through his providence, sends this way of escape for David. And he then lives another day. This rock is called the Rock of Escape. But finally, he finds a place to rest. David had been actively pursued. And Saul is back to what you might call his day job, what he should be doing the majority of his time. And maybe they were coming to attack Gilboa, his hometown, and therefore he was like, I need to go back to be able to defend it. But even as we see, the Lord does not call Saul away at the beginning, but right at the last minute, when he's right about to grab David. There's moments in David's life where he has been on run like a big deer on the first day of deer season. yet the Lord's hand is still moving. The water of the king's heart. God has given David, ever since he left his house that night, when his prowling dogs were roaming around his house. Although he's been fleeing for his life, he has given him some short but sweet moments of rest and even sweet moments of fellowship. David has came, and it's not this long period, but he finally comes and sits down at Engedi. And Engedi actually means the spring of the goat. It gets its name from this fresh water spring located there, and then from there many wild goats come and live in this area so they can drink this water. It's located on the west coast of the Dead Sea. Now this is not home for David. This is not a place where David is finally to be able to set up his lazy boy. However, at this moment where David catches his breath, he can drink water to be able to sustain his soul. And we find in our lives, sometimes it feels that our head is underwater and we cannot breathe. We feel like Saul has been chasing us, pursuing us. But God does give us a chance to be able to sit down and rest. Although it might not be for a long time, He gives us that sweet fellowship, that sweet moment of rest. We find this every Lord's Day when we come, we sit down and we pause, and the Lord calls us to worship Him, to set our minds and our worries and our woes at the door, at the threshold, to set our gaze up into the heavens, to be encouraged by our brother beside us like David was with Jonathan. 2 Corinthians, Paul writes in chapter 4, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so life of Jesus may be manifested in our bodies. So we who live are always been given over to death for Jesus' sake. So the life of Jesus also has been manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you." And here Paul is explaining the great cost it is to be a minister of the gospel. Yet he does so that the breath of life might come. At our old church, we used to, the motto used to be serving others for Jesus' sake, which was from earlier in this passage. And I always thought about maybe we should change it for dying for Jesus' sake. You know, and that this life, we really see the great sacrifice, because this life is not all there is. We might find moments of rest, but we will never find true rest here in this world. The David might seem lost, and many times, maybe feeling like his heart is depleted, ready to throw in the towel. But yet, throughout all this, he still serves God faithfully. He still serves God. He serves God while he is alone. He serves God when he is a shepherd to the 600 men that follow him. He knows his true calling is not to fight Saul, but to serve God. And the Lord does see him through. You wonder at times, why doesn't God just step in, and why does he push David through all this? Why isn't Saul just wiped out? There's many instances you could think of providentially where the Lord would be able to use his hand to be able to change the course of a Philistine's arrow or spear. But yet the Lord does so, and he sees David through all of it. He sees him through these hard times, all preparing him to be able to continue to serve God. But Job, at the start of Job, Satan comes to God and says, you know, God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Satan says, "Well, it's because he's got everything. You take away all the things in his hand, and finally, he'll curse you." The whole story of Job centers around taking everything from Job, yet God, Job still not cursing the Lord. Same too with David. He has his moments of weakness, but yet overall, his heart is still to serve God. Not just in the palace, but in the cave. Not just when he's resting, but when he's running as well. Let our hearts be same as we think about this race that we run. Let us fight that fight. Let us endure for this race, still holding on to that faith which is given once for all for the saints.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.